fun to do bad things.
That's real, yo. I'm not exaggerating at all, man. The more money you make, the more problems you get. And jealousy and envy is something that comes with the territory, man. A lot of people, it's just negative energy, like my man Puff said.
What country you from?
What?
What ain't no country I ever heard of? They speak English and what?
What?
English, mother, do you speak it?
Man, you been doing all this dope producing. You ain't had a chance to show them what time it is.
So what you want me to do?
Welcome to the Spurs Cast, the original San Antonio Spurs podcast.
We are now joined by Mike Monroe, longtime NBA reporter, is now covering the Spurs for the Rivard Report. Sir, absolutely honored to have you on the show with us today. We're here talking about your new book, 100 Things That Spurs Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Welcome to the Spurs Cast, Mike.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And we're joined here, as always, by Jose. Jose, say hello.
Hi, and Mr. Monroe, you have legitimized us, so thank you. We can't repay you
wow.
for that.
Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mentioned a little bit in the pre-show that, you know, not only are Jose and I fans, you know, of yours, but for a long time, but fans of this book itself. I bought this book. I think I got this on Friday, Mike, and I sat there for about 3 hours and just plowed right through this. And it's not to say that this is a quick read. This thing is almost 300 pages long. I mean, this is a very comprehensive history of the San Antonio Spurs, and I love all the little call-outs inside of it, right? So I think it's just filled with facts and just a really great story about the San Antonio Spurs, and I just couldn't separate away from it. So I really just, got through it in about 3 hours. But, you know, I've dog-eared a bunch of pages here to come back to because I thought, man, I didn't know that. There's a lot of facts in here.
Well, give me a big warm feeling with that. That's so good to hear. That was my intent when I wrote it. I know how passionate San Antonians are about the Spurs. You know, I was in Denver for 33 years, and I told a lot of people I thought that Broncomania was a real thing. that there couldn't be any fans more loyal and insane, really, than Broncomaniacs until I got to San Antonio, and the love affair between San Antonio and the Spurs is real, and it's meaningful. It's just the Spurs are a major part of this community in every way, I think the Spurs sort of bring the entire community together, and it's something that you don't often see anywhere, and so it's really kind of cool.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, and you referenced that you came from Colorado. For those Spurs fans that don't know about your history, talk about that. Why did you come from Colorado to South Texas?
Well, I'll go back in my. I'll give you a quick resume, if you will. I started out in sports writing in 1968 in Colorado Springs, Colorado, writing for the now defunct Colorado Springs Free Press, and I covered my first professional basketball game in 1968, the Denver Rockets versus the New Orleans. Wait a minute, were they the Buccaneers? Yes, the Buccaneers. I've told a lot of people this story. Here I was 21 years old, and sort of, you know, a real neophyte, and stars in my eyes and the whole thing. And I walked into the Denver Rockets, the team that became the Nuggets, the Denver Rockets locker room after the first pro basketball game that I had ever covered. And about three quarters of the players in the locker room were smoking, and they all had little buckets of beer, little ice buckets of beer. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what happened to training rules?
Yeah.
These guys are all smoking, they're drinking beer. What is this?
Well, it's how we do the show here, by the way.
Yeah, well, there you go. Good idea. I went from Colorado Springs to Denver in 1971, and I spent as many nights as possible watching the old Denver Rockets and then the Nuggets at the old Auditorium Arena in downtown Denver, which was about two blocks from the Denver Post building where I went to work. And I was at the Denver Post for 30 years. Beginning in 1985, I was assigned to cover the Denver Nuggets. And I feel really blessed to have covered NBA basketball at a golden age, not just of NBA of NBA basketball. You know, these were the Magic Johnson, Larry Bird years, and Julius Erving, and a lot of other great players and great teams. And but it was not just that as much for me as it was a great time to be covering NBA basketball. In those days, the writers flew on the same commercial aircraft with the teams. They rode the team bus from the airport to the hotel, from the hotel to the arena. Excuse me. And you actually developed relationships with coaches and players because you were just thrown into situations. You have a plane delay, and you're stuck in an airport with the guys, and everybody has a shared experience, and it was a different time. Practices were completely open. You just walked into practice anytime you wanted to. The access to players was really completely unfettered. I mean, you could talk to anyone and everyone, and it was a great, great time to be covering the NBA. Things have changed a bit. I've really covered primarily nothing but the NBA since 1985, with the occasional, you know, Broncos playoff game sidebar here and there, and a golf tournament here and there. So, but primarily I've done nothing but NBA basketball since 1985.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, it was a different time. You could cover sports differently. How has that changed back then to social media now? I was blessed enough for Project Spurs to let me go, you know, for Summer League. And, you know, you get all these bloggers and all these different people going. And, I mean, it's everybody fighting to get the news out at the, you know, right when it happens. Everybody's tweeting. You know, what's the difference, the huge difference between now and then for you?
Well, it is a huge difference. And you know, now scoops are measured in seconds, and back in the day, when it was primarily newspaper writers doing the daily coverage, with some, you know, some radio and you know, a scant few TV people actually trying to report the news. Back in the day, you know, you would write a story and you would get up in the morning. And in Denver, there were two competing newspapers. And if I thought I had a scoop, I would get up early in the morning and go to the porch and pick up the Rocky Mountain News, the competing newspaper, and see if my competitor had also gotten the story that I thought I had a scoop on. And I'm happy to say that 9 times out of 10, he didn't. But and then the flip side of that coin was, sometimes you would go to the go pick up the paper and open it up, and you've been beaten on a big story, and so it was completely different. There was no social media, of course, it was highly competitive, but it's impossible to relate how different it was to people who now understand that, you know, if you're off Twitter for 30 minutes, you might miss a big story, right? And so it was totally, totally different. And I guess I sound like an old fogey, but I kind of miss the old days.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask you about those old days, because I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you for a Dikembe Mutombo story. With all your time there in Denver, what was it like having Dikembe come to town? This is one of my all-time favorite players, me personally. What was it like having Dikembe come to town? What was that experience like? How did you feel about him leaving as well?
Well, yeah, Dikembe is larger than life, literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. He is the most outgoing, sort of fill up a room guy that I've ever been around. And I'll tell you, one of my favorite stories about Dikembe is that I discovered about a year and a half into his career with the Nuggets, when, you know, we were taught, had, you know, he was a go-to guy in the locker room. And so I discovered that by accident, that if you put your tape recorder playback on the fast speed instead of the normal speed, that it was easier to understand him. He had that big, deep voice, and he spoke, you know, he spoke in that the sort of basso profundo voice. And as I say, it was a complete accident that the speed button had been pushed up to whatever the high speed was. And I'm saying, wow, I can understand Dikembe a whole lot better. But Dikembe and I actually became very good friends. Anytime we're in the same arena, we always have a nice reunion. He's a big-hearted guy who I wish there were more players like Dikembe. And of course, he's done amazing good works in Africa, in Congo, and just really, I was so thrilled to see him go to the Hall of Fame. Well deserved, and he's a Hall of Fame person as well as a Hall of Fame player.
Oh, wonderful! And I've always been a follower of his. I love the finger wagging back and forth. The guy's skill is unbelievable. It's always good to hear a good story because, you know, despite, hearing these kinds of stories from him, most people don't know, Dikembe and his big personality and his big heart.
Well, I promise you, he's just, he had a sibling who died, and forgive me, I'm forgetting at the moment whether it was a sister or a brother. I believe it was a brother who died, and Dikembe adopted all of his children. And that's just one example of the kind of big-hearted person that he is. But Deke was a tremendous guy to cover, and of course, a great player, and part of that that Nuggets team that became the first number 8 seed to knock off the number 1 seed back in the 93. The years run together. The 93 or 94 first round, when Denver beat Seattle after Seattle had the best record in the entire league, and they won game 5. First rounds used to be 5 game series. And they won game 5 in Seattle in overtime. And it really was one of the most compelling games that I've ever had the privilege to cover.
Well, switching gears to get to the topic at hand, your book, and I just was exalting,
yes,
this book. I think it's fantastic. It's so deep into, I mean, there's 100 things inside of this book, and we could go for an hour and a half, and I know we don't have that much of your time, so... You know, Jose and I wanted to ask you a few questions about the book, and starting with, how did you come up with the idea to write this book, a listing of 100 things that Spurs fans should know before they die?
Okay, well, this is the concept is actually a franchise of Triumph Publications out of Chicago. They have done this same book, if you will, 100 Things book, about many of the great franchises in sports history, the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Bulls and the Lakers and the probably a dozen or so of the great sports franchises, the Giants and the Oakland A's even, and they decided they wanted a book about the Spurs, and rightly so, because we're talking about the great franchises in sports history, right? Mm-hmm. And the Spurs certainly qualify. And they actually pitched the idea to one of the writers who had done several of their books for them, and my friend Steve Springer, who is retired now from the Los Angeles Times and was asked to do the book. He says, "Oh, no, you have to call Mike Monroe in San Antonio. There's your guy to do the Spurs book." And so that's how that came about. And a little interesting sidebar to that is that my deadline was actually we signed the contract after the Spurs won the 2014 championship. Mm-hmm. And I had a deadline of October 1st of 2015 to finish the book. And I made the deadline. But in the interim, of course, the Spurs had been eliminated in the first round in 2015, and then gone out and signed LaMarcus Aldridge and David West. And I told the editor that I'd worked with, I really think we should wait another year for publication, because I think the Spurs are going to have another great season, and they'll be a championship contender again. And he agreed with me, and we decided to wait. And yes, indeed, they had the best season in franchise history, and then we know what else happened. Right. They got beat by the Thunder in the second round, and we never got that great Western Conference Finals matchup that we'd all anticipated between the Spurs and the 73 win Warriors. But nonetheless, we then waited at my insistence to see what Tim Duncan would decide to do. I just told him, I said, we cannot publish this book until we know if Tim's going to retire. And they agreed, even though it kind of put a crimp in their publication schedule. And so, as you know, there is a chapter in there called The End of an Era, mm-hmm. About Tim's retirement, and included one of the little 26 little sidebars that are also in the book is the letter that he wrote to Spurs fans, yeah. on Spurs.com. Loved Tim, you know. So that's sort of the long and short of how the book came about, and I had a great deal of fun researching it and writing it. And believe me, when I started, I said, "Wow, 100 things—that's a lot of things." And then I started listing them, and it didn't take me long to realize 100 things is not enough.
Yeah,
there could be 200 things. We narrowed it down to the 100 things that are in the book, and 8 of those deal with Tim Duncan primarily, and I make no apology for that. And as you know, number one, and they're ordered 1 through 100 in order of importance as I see them. And I don't think too many people will quibble with my choice of Tim Duncan as the number one thing in the book.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I was going to ask you about your writing process, but you really laid it out there that, you know, you started your research, you started listing off 100 things, and you thought that that's just not quite enough. And let me ask you, what was the 101st thing?
We actually ended up consolidating a couple of things, mm-hmm. and there were a couple of things that fell by the wayside. And at the top of my head, I can't remember. And maybe it's best not revealed anyway. Might hurt someone's feelings. I will tell you one that got left out. And I was sort of this person probably will be glad that it didn't make the book. It was the worst draft pick in franchise history, which was Al Frederick Hughes in, I believe, 1985 or 6. Well, it was the Karl Malone draft because the player who went immediately ahead of Al Frederick Hughes was Karl Malone. Mm-hmm. So there's some bad luck, right?
Right.
But Al Frederick
depends
Hughes
who you
was
ask.
Al Frederick Hughes was a prolific scorer at Loyola of Chicago, and he was a complete bust as an NBA player. And one of the little tidbits that I learned about Al Frederick Hughes was that he played. His senior year, I believe he was at Loyola. He was, I believe, he led the country in scoring, and did not have a single assist. So that's really kind of all you need to know about Al Frederick Hughes. But that he didn't make the book. So enough said about poor Al Frederick.
Well, you mentioned luck in your last statement there. How lucky are the Spurs? And I don't want to give too much away in your book. I want people to go out there and buy it so they own this. But, you know, I can't even make it through the first 20 pages before I see probably the two luckiest events in Spurs history, certainly, but maybe in all of humankind. Let's talk about our hurricane that upsets Tim right. Duncan's swimming future, and then David Robinson being right. too tall for active duty.
Well, there you go. These are amazing happenstance circumstances that benefited the Spurs. Not to mention their luck in the lotteries, in which they ended up with the number one pick when David Robinson was eligible for the draft, and when Tim Duncan was eligible for the draft. One of my favorite sidebars in the book is the amazing tidbit that there actually was a second player who was briefly considered for the number one pick in the 1997 draft. If you read the book, you know that was Scott Pollard, who was a 7-foot center from Kansas.
Yep.
And I discovered this when I was following the Spurs as Pop was approaching win number 1,000, and which actually came in Indiana, in Indianapolis. And Scott Pollard now is a broadcaster for the Indiana Pacers. And before the game, Pop was on 999 wins, and there was quite a large contingent of media following the Spurs at this point, and they were asking him about all sorts of things, and he was talking about how fortunate he was to have had, Tim Duncan for the bulk of his, all but really his first season as the coach of the Spurs, and everything he's done he owes to Tim Duncan, et cetera, et cetera. And Scott Pollard is there in the media scrum, and Pop has volunteered the information that, we actually consider another player, and he's standing right here to Scott Pollard. Scott Pollard's mouth just fell to the floor, and he was unaware that the Spurs had ever considered him as well. But I think that's one of the real fun facts that's in the book that a lot of people were entirely unaware of. But the Spurs were indeed extremely fortunate, as you say, because of the Hurricane Hugo that hit St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, where Tim Duncan was a promising Olympic swimmer, potential Olympic swimmer, was setting, age group records and so forth. And the hurricane hits St. Croix and destroys the swimming pool in which he trained and competed, and so then he turned his athletic pursuits to basketball, and of course David Robinson, as you say, after graduation from the Naval Academy, had a commitment to serve in active duty in the Navy, and that benefited the Spurs as well.
You know, your book has several lists in here, and again, I don't want to get in deep on the lists, but it, you know, if I look at Popovich's coaching tree, which you outline in this book, which I've always been interested in coaching trees. I think that, you know, influences that people have on the rest of the league can be felt in a pretty widespread way. And you go through his coaching tree. Talk about that. How prolific is Greg Popovich and his influence on the league?
Well, it's teams have been trying to emulate the Spurs way for a long time, and one of the easiest ways to do that is to, you know, is to steal the assistant coaches who know exactly how Pop goes about his business, right? And Pop would tell you that he's part of someone else's coaching tree, and that would be Don Nelson, because he was an assistant for Don Nelson and also Larry Brown, mm-hmm. who actually, as you know from reading the book, when Pop took a sabbatical from his college coaching at Pomona Pitzer, he landed up as an intern assistant coach for Larry Brown at the University of Kansas, where there was a graduate assistant coach named R.C. Buford. That's where the two of them met. And then when Larry got the job as the head coach of the Spurs in 1987, he brought both Pop and R.C. to his staff. And so Pop would tell you that he's part of Larry's tree, he's part of Don Nelson's tree, but they definitely had an influence on the way Greg Popovich coaches the Spurs. But yeah, his tree is pretty prolific, and just to show you how difficult it is, though, that, you know, the coaches that has come, the coaches that have come from his tree, have not always had the same kind of success the Spurs have had. You know, Steve Kerr certainly has to be in part of that tree as well, because he played for Pop and won two championships under Pop. Mike Budenholzer, I think, has a chance in Atlanta to have a Popovichian-like career. I think Bud probably approximates Pop's approach more so than any of the other coaches that have come out of his tree. But yeah, it's a pretty amazing thing.
You know, out of all of the Spurs that you've covered, who would you say is the most underrated San Antonio Spur?
Oh gosh. Wow. That's a great question.
I'd like to take credit underrated for that, but that's Jose. That's Jose's question that I'm asking.
Okay. Jose. That's a good one. The most underrated Spurs player. Wow.
Jose wanted to say Fabricio Oberto, but I told him to let you answer.
Yeah.
No. Do you need time? I'll give you my own personal one. I always thought the most underrated one was Michael Finley. And me and Ryan were discussing this because you mentioned him in your book. But I always thought when he went in 2006, that sort of changed the dynamic of what the Spurs image was, where you can bring somebody in there, you know, a guy who was a superstar with the Mavs. Yeah, he was hurt, but he still thought he could play. And then he could fit in that role. Pop could make guys fit into a system. It wasn't, you're going to come and you're going to do exactly what we say. I mean, he had trouble, you know, coming off the bench early on. But again, Pop made it as comfortable as he could for him. I really think that he's underrated because of that, because he was open to whatever the Spurs were going to give him, but he also shined with what Pop helped them accomplish there.
No, I wouldn't disagree with that. Finn, you know, that they it was unfortunate that you know, they locked up with the Mavericks that year when they had the two best records in the NBA. They locked up in the second round, and the Spurs lost that memorable 7-game series to the Mavericks that season. But that was a tough break for Finn. But you know. Underrated. I think that Alberto's not a bad choice because he did so many of the little things that that people don't notice. He was a solid interior defender and rebounder, and a terrific interior passer. Maybe Boris Diaw, simply from the fact that that Boris was not a prolific scorer, but he did so many of the little things, and especially the passing, and so many players loved playing with him. And when they won that 2014 championship, you know, putting him in the starting lineup really, really jump-started that run of beautiful basketball. You know, maybe he's not underrated. Maybe Spurs fans consider him a great player, but Boris would be in the conversation for sure. And you're probably gonna laugh about this, but I think maybe Rasho Nesterovic deserves consideration.
Thank you. I told you you were gonna laugh. I've been advocating for Rasho for years, and I know Jose's got a big smile on his face. You've made me so happy by mentioning Nesterovic.
Rasho, again, the same thing. He was not a scorer, but Rasho knew his role. He just needed to be more aggressive with it and have a little more confidence in his game. He wasn't a bad shooter, but he also did the little things. He set a really mean pick. He knew how to block out. He was a solid interior defender. So he's got to be in the conversation too. That's a great question.
And they signed him primarily to guard Shaq at a point where Shaq was still Shaq to an extent. So, I mean, he earned, I think he
of course.
Earned like $14 yeah. million right a year. So I'll agree with you there. It's not right. an easy cover for him to go to a team to do right. that.
Right.
Well, we'll get you out of here on this. On the current team, how do you feel about your 2016-2017 San Antonio Spurs? And how do you think they're doing this year? What can we expect from them the rest of the year?
Well, listen, I did not think they would get off to as good a start as they have. Certainly didn't think they would blow out the Warriors in the season opener. I think Spurs fans should be really encouraged that they're 8-3, having played five games without Tony Parker and let's see. Eight games without Danny Green, eight or nine games without Danny Green. You're talking about 40% of your starting lineup that really hasn't been there for a good chunk of the season, and that also has an effect on your second unit as well, because obviously some players are coming up from the second unit to take those starting spots. So I think it's an encouraging start, and there is tremendous room for growth. Pau Gasol is going to be much better in March and April than he is right now in the Spurs system. And Kawhi Leonard is just getting better and better and better, and he's already a monster. The best two-way player in the NBA, in my opinion, at this point. And so I think there are great things in store. I think the Spurs are going to win between 55 and 60 games. And, you know, the Clippers are terrific, better than I thought they were going to be. They're off to a great start. The Warriors are the Warriors, and there's some other terrific teams in the West. But I think the Spurs are going to have I think they're contenders again. They've got to have some luck with health. Mono's is off to a good start. Tony has had the hyperextended knee, kind of a slow start. But and let me just finish with, I think Tony is not appreciated by Spurs fans to the extent that he should be. And I actually have a piece that's going to be on up on Bleacher Report about Tony, probably Thursday morning. That speaks to this issue, and I had a nice conversation with Greg Popovich about that, and he's in agreement that Tony hasn't been appreciated as much as he deserves to be. You're talking about a guy who was the team's leading scorer and was asked by Pop to take a different role and be a facilitator, and has done so. And he was not ranked in the top 100 in Sports mm-hmm. Illustrated's list of the 100 best NBA players, and I think they missed the boat on that. I think he's still a very important player in what the Spurs are going to do. And, you know, he's played seven games and they're 6-1 in his seven games as a starter. So I think the Spurs are positioned quite well right now.
I know Ryan wanted that to be the last question, but I got to ask you this. Since you're in the trenches, since you talk to the Spurs, and I mean, you're in the know, what's the biggest difference that you can see with the post-Duncan Spurs compared to when Duncan was out there? I mean, we're seeing them a little bit more lively or a little bit more emotion, but what's the biggest difference that you see post-Tim Duncan era?
Well, you really see just what a great interior defender Tim was. And I'm not talking about a shot block or anything like that. I'm talking about always knowing where to be and always helping his teammates be in the proper spot. And I don't know how much you ever watched Tim on the defensive end, always talking to his teammates and positioning them. Sometimes, you know, put a hand on a guy's hip and move him over 2 feet, you know, because that's where he needed to be. He is one of the greatest interior defenders in NBA history, and I think that's where it shows up. They're not quite as robust in their interior defense right now as they were. Pau is a solid shot blocker because of his length, but Pau Gasol is not a great interior defender as Tim Duncan was, and that's not really a knock on Pau as much as it is a comment about what a great interior defender Tim was.
His name is Mike Monroe. His book is 100 Things Spurs Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. He's currently writing for the Rivard Report. Mike, on Twitter, I know you're very active on Twitter. You even have Robin Lopez following you on Twitter. Where can Spurs cast fans engage with you in the Twitterverse?
I'm sorry, at Monroe_SA. That's me on Twitter.
Mike, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We're deeply honored. We're huge fans. I know that our followers are fans. And we thank you just sincerely for spending the time with us and talking about this book that, you know, to me, to be honest with you, I think if you look on page 200 of this book and you just look at the picture, and by the way, there's wonderful pictures throughout this book. Look at the picture for every Spurscast fan that's going to purchase this book. Look on page 200. Look at a picture of that kid looking over the Riverwalk at the parade. That tells you all you need to know about San Antonio Spurs. Mike, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, and if I could say there's one more thing that Spurs fans need to know and do before they die, they need to buy this book.
I agree. That's the 101st thing.
There you go.
Mike,
thank you. Thank you, fellas. It was my pleasure. I appreciate the interest.
Thank you, sir. Have a wonderful day.